Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I'm grateful to the subscribers who support this effort, including Eugene Kenny, Julie Dupree, Paul Elsesser, and Kathy Burwell. You can get details on our subscriptions at peterbcollins.com. This podcast is being distributed absolutely free to all listeners.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
And I, boy, and I, a 2 for 2. Vote for me and I'll set you free.
Vote for me and I'll set you free. Coming up in the second segment of our podcast today, Ted Rall, the cartoonist, author, and commentator, will join us. And he's had enough. His new book is called The Book of Obama. And after spending time with Occupy, Ted Rall says it's time for a revolution. We'll hear him out later on in this podcast. But first, it's the second installment of our new series related to the efforts to overturn the onerous Citizens United case decided by the Supreme Court a couple of years back, unleashing millions, if not more than $1 billion this year, in corporate cash into our political campaigns. And activist Adam Furgach and attorney Carl Mayer return with us today as we talk about this effort to use an appeal from the State Supreme Court of Montana, which is due to hit the Supreme Court. And they will have to make a decision sometime starting on June 14th whether the Supreme Court accepts this appeal, which appears to violate the 11th Amendment, or rejects the appeal, which would then allow the Montana decision to stand, and that is a huge hole in the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. Carl, Adam, thanks for joining me again today.
Thank you, Peter. We appreciate your experience and your knowledge and understanding of how important this case is.
Adam, cut the crap. I just want my country back, okay? And I can't sit still and watch the plutocracy run the show. We saw this year in stark relief that about 24 fat cats funded the super PACs, the independent expenditures, on behalf of various Republican presidential nominees. And that just shows the power of concentrated money in politics and how that skews inevitably to the right wing. And so in yesterday's installment, we sketched out the novel legal strategy that Carl Mayer has put into play here. And we encouraged our listeners to call Governor Brian Schweitzer in Montana and the state's Attorney General, Steve Bullock. And I don't just idly hand out activist advice and expect you to follow up. I picked up the phone and made a couple of calls to Montana. First to Governor Schweitzer's office, where a fairly pleasant woman took my information and just said, thank you for calling. They didn't note that I'm calling from California. They may or may not have used caller ID, but they didn't ask that. So if you feel a little bit uneasy about making that call because you're not a Montanan, put it out of your mind and pick up the phone and call them. You can also call Attorney General Steve Bullock. An individual answered the phone there. I said I would like him to embrace the argument for jurisdiction, the issue of jurisdiction, and that's the principle that Carl Mayer has presented, that the Supreme Court does not have jurisdiction over this Montana appeal. Gentlemen, has there been any movement in the last 24 hours since we've spoken in terms of Montana's position in essentially upgrading your amicus brief to something that is a part of the state's argument presented to the Supreme Court.
Picking up from yesterday, where it stands now is we filed the amicus brief, which laid out the argument that the 11th Amendment to the Constitution forbids the Supreme Court from taking the case. And that means that Montana's strict laws will stand, Citizens United be effectively reversed. But it's best if Montana actually raises this 11th Amendment argument. Our amicus brief can only go so far. It's best if the state itself does it. It doesn't negate the chance that we will be heard, but it improves their chances greatly.
Understood.
So we have sent them things. We have sent them a one-page motion, and it's called a conditional motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, which will bring this immediately to the attention of the court before next week when they're going to have a conference on it. And that's what we are. We presented it to them. We have not yet heard back definitively whether they will do this or not. And we are encouraging people to call Attorney General Bullock's office. I will give the number. If everybody's got a pen, it's area code 406-444-2026. That's 444-2026. And Governor Schweitzer is area code 406-444-3111. That's 444-3111. And specifically ask them to file this one-page motion that team, that's our group, the 11th Amendment Movement team, has provided so that they make sure that this argument is raised before the court before next week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people think, well, they don't listen. Well, believe me, an attorney general in Montana may get 50 calls a year from people on something. So if we can get 50 calls today and call today, or as soon as you hear this, just call. Dial early and dial often.
Yeah, there is no limit of one person, one vote in this case.
That's right, and you can Skype them for free.
Uh huh.
So but let me give we have heard. Let me add just a little bit.
Peter, sure, Carl.
This is Carl Mayer. We have heard through back channels though that the Attorney General's office and the Governor's office are starting to feel the scrutiny of the public. That we've heard through back channels that they're starting to realize that this may be something they should embrace with open arms. Let me give some background here, because I think probably your listeners and haven't really heard that much about what's happened in Montana, and it is blacked out in the corporate media, as you point out often. And I'm very delighted that you're on top of this story. Let me quote from the governor of Montana, and you very rarely hear a governor speak in these terms. Okay. This is what Governor Schweitzer said about this whole issue. He said, quote, "This business of allowing corporations to bribe their way into government has got to stop." And he continued on. This is an interview he gave last year with the local radio station. He continued on and said, "This is our government, and we are not going to allow any corporation to steal it from us," end quote. See, now, people are not used to in this country hearing governors talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
What we're trying to do is get Governor Schweitzer to put actions behind his word. And in a certain sense, he has, because he's called for a referendum on this issue, and they have put in a brief on this case. But we're asking them to take an additional, stronger step of asserting the sovereign rights of Montana should not be violated by the Supreme Court taking the petition and telling Montana how to run its own election, and telling Montana that their Supreme Court can't issue a ruling which says corporate money stays out of politics, and this is the will of our people, and there's no business of a federal court undermining a sovereign interest this way. Essentially, if I could put it metaphorically, Peter, Governor Schweitzer has said that he wants to light a prairie fire on this issue. You know, he's hearkening back to the populist days of the 19th century. He wants the issue of getting corporate money out of politics to spread like a prairie fire all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a little frustrated, however, because we feel that we're giving the governor the match, the kerosene, the kindling wood, and he's all ready to start the prairie fire, but for some reason he won't light the match. And all he's got to do is sign a one-page motion that will say to the Supreme Court, hands off the Montana Supreme Court and our election laws, which state that corporate money can't be used in politics.
Now, give me a quick point of procedure here, Carl. Is it the governor or the attorney general who finally would sign off on whether this motion is included in the presentation to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I'm sorry. I may have exaggerated the point. It is the attorney general of Montana, Steve Bullock, who has ultimate decision-making power. However,
Attorney General Bullock is also even perhaps more strongly on the record as being quoted as saying that I will do everything possible to defend this case. He said that in January, just after the Montana Supreme Court decision upheld, and it was probably going to get appealed to the Supreme Court. So he's on the record, too, to doing everything they can. So we are encouraging them. Carl can attest there really is zero downside ramifications of filing this simple motion and raising the issue.
Now, Governor Schweitzer published an op-ed in the New York Times on June 3rd in which he, in simple terms, recaps the history of Montana's corruption, the 1912 initiative that outlawed corporate money in politics. And let me quote a couple of items here from his op-ed. He said, those laws have nurtured a rare, pure form of democracy. There's very little money in Montana politics. Legislators are volunteers. They're ranchers, teachers who put their professions on hold to serve a 90-day session every other year for a mere $80 a day. And he goes on, since money can't be used to gain access, public contact with politicians is easy. He said, if a person wants to meet with a public official, even the governor, you can pretty much just walk into the Capitol and say hello. He said, all this is in jeopardy, though, thanks to the Supreme Court and its infamous Citizens United ruling. In February, the court notified the Office of Montana's Commissioner of Political Practices, which oversees state campaigns, that until further notice, we may no longer enforce our anti-corruption statute, specifically our restriction on corporate money. And he said the effects are already being felt. The ink wasn't even dry when corporate front groups started funneling lots of cash into our legislative races. And now he said that ghost-written legislation is appearing on his desk, similar to the process of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. So the governor is pretty full-throated in his objection to the central issue. But what we need is activists to contact his office to push him over the edge to embrace the a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction.
I have no argument. No, it is an initiative that the people can actually have an effect on, in our opinion, that they are listening. They're just, look, this issue of a state claiming a sovereign right, okay, now that's a big step, even for a state, but that is what the Constitution says. It allows for it, and it's actually fundamental to our republic form of government and the separation of the federal government getting too much power. This is how they framed it, and this is how this state can claim their rights to pass their own election laws, enforce their own election laws, and not have a private group, a corporation now, dictate to a sovereign state what their law should be. This is the crux of the 11th Amendment argument, that a private corporation or a private person cannot sue a state in a federal court. Now, there are other ways that they may have redress. The Constitution allows for the Congress, an elected branch, to pass some measure that would specifically address this issue for that state.
Correct.
Or the other elected branch, the executive branch, the president, the Justice Department, on behalf of all the states, if the issue was important enough, if a state was out of line, they could sue the state on behalf of all the states. But those are the elected branches that reflect the broad will of the people. They can do it, but the Supreme Court, the federal courts, are appointees. And the framers of the Constitution were very aware that to allow a few appointees power over a sovereign state to change their law, that was not what the states were going to agree to when they signed up for the Constitution back, you know, in 1789. I got my dates, yeah.
So, I know it's so, in that zone somewhere.
Right, right. So the states knew that when they signed up, they were going to be free of an appointed judiciary who possibly is corruptible. And I'm not saying that any Supreme Court judiciary is, or this one, but the framers saw that possibility, so they created the wording in the Constitution, and then they clarified it later with the 11th Amendment, and later rulings. Now, it's the oldest amendment after the Bill of Rights, so there's more than 200 years of narrowing what is allowed, and our argument shows that this type of suit is clearly not allowed, and Montana should have the rights to make their own laws.
Carl, would you like to add?
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. The other point I want to make for progressive listeners is you shouldn't fear a states' rights argument, which is what the 11th Amendment is, because the 11th Amendment argument we're making is, in a sense, pretty narrow. We're saying that Montana's sovereign interest in this case is preventing corporate influence on its democratic process, and that sovereign interest is paramount, and that is that sovereign interest that the Supreme Court cannot intrude into. You know, there may be other areas of life where the Supreme Court could intrude into states' rights, for example, the right to privacy or the right to due process, etc. But what we're saying in our brief is that the sovereign right to protect corrupting corporate influence, to protect the democracy from corrupting corporate money and influence, is so important that the Supreme Court can't go near it. A federal court can't touch it. And so I want to give comfort to progressives who are worried about making this argument.
Well, let's just air out here the abuses of the 11th Amendment in the past, most notably to support segregation, and that Southern states and you had George Wallace as the banner carrier of the states' rights movement, and that was a thinly veiled effort to maintain segregation as the civil rights movement was making gains in the late 50s and early 60s. And so there are some ugly precedents that were attempted or set under the 11th Amendment. But yes. I consider this to be a kind of renewal of a very positive use to assert the independence of a state's judiciary, particularly in the circumstances we've described.
That's right. And what we're saying is it's very important to carve out an exception under the 11th Amendment, whereby whatever else you can say about what state statutes are passed or what actions a state court takes, when it comes to running elections in a state, when it comes to basic democracy at the grassroots level, that's where the state has a paramount interest, and that's where the federal courts shouldn't interfere. So that's a very important distinction we're making. I also want to say, in terms of giving comfort to listeners who are progressive and are not familiar with this strategy or tactic, I believe I wrote the first article back in 1990, the first law review article on getting rid of corporate personhood and the importance of stripping corporations of their Bill of Rights protections under the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very devoted to the idea that we need to do this. And the referendum process, creating a constitutional amendment, all of those are terrific things to work on. But we have an immediate job here in the next 6 days, really, coming up, which is we have an opportunity to really take the sting out of Citizens United by protecting the state of Montana efforts to keep corporate money out of politics, and that will translate into every state in the nation. So it's a different strategy that people aren't used to, but it's time for progressives to try some different strategies, because we keep losing to the large power of money in these, you know, as we saw in a recall effort in elections, where essentially the game is rigged. So we're trying something different. So what we're saying is, rather than just keep running the ball up the middle of the field, where the corporations have paid for a lot of corporate linebackers to stop the ball, we try and end around. That's what we're doing here. We want to try and end around and immediately have an impact in whittling away Citizens United.
Now, many people have become aware of the issue of corporate personhood, and it originally goes back to a case that's more than 100 years old, the railroad versus Santa Clara County, California. But I want to ask you, in the brief that you've written, Carl, you refer to corporate personhood as fiction, and I support that position. I'm just wondering if this is the right place to mention that, since you're trying to get the most conservative wing of the Supreme Court to rule in your favor on the 11th Amendment argument.
Right. Well, the personhood issue really isn't part of our strategy. It was mentioned, but what we're really focusing on is the sovereign immunity of the state.
Right.
And what we're really dealing with is another fiction that the court has erected called the Young fiction. That has allowed some lawsuits to proceed in federal court against states.
Mm-hmm.
And that Young fiction is something that has gradually been cut back on by the conservative justices. They have increasingly said that the Young fiction.
Carl, let me just jump in. You know, we're getting a little technical here, perhaps for the listeners. I'll just say that Young fiction, and I'll describe it very succinctly here, is what attracted me to even getting involved. Because when I looked at some of the possible things, I saw there's this rule that says, okay, if the 11th Amendment says that a private corporation cannot sue a state, what happened was 100 years ago, the court ruled, well, if they sue the a state officer by name, in this case, the Attorney General of Montana is Steve Bullock. If they sue Steve Bullock as the Attorney General of Montana, that's not, as he's doing his official duties, that's not really suing the state. So as long as you say that we're suing Steve Bullock, and not Montana or not the Attorney General, then it's okay. And this is a fiction. It's mm-hmm. it's a way around. Now, a normal person would say, well, how he's going to sue the person, but he's doing his official duty. It's suing the state. And that's what our brief goes into in depth. And what this court, actually the justices on this court, have narrowed down, as Carl was saying, that when you sue the person, if it's indistinguishable from their official duties, it is if you're suing the state, and that is not allowed.
Well, as the amateur here, I have to say I've seen numerous lawsuits filed against officers of the state, and when those officers change, like in California when Schwarzenegger left and Brown took over, they just substitute the name of the current official. But it's not a personal lawsuit against Jerry Brown. It is in his function as the governor of California. So that's pretty clear to me.
Right, but what the Supreme Court has established as a fiction is that just by suing the officer in their individual capacity, you get around the 11th Amendment bar. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the many fictions involved in these cases that the public looks at and scratches their head and says, what is this fiction? It's like some sort of virtual reality here, because you have the same thing in Citizens United. Citizens United relies on the fiction number one, that a corporation is a person, and then it relies on the second fiction that money is speech. So it's like you have to live in some weird alternative universe to accept those big fat lies and calling them something polite like a fiction,
uh-huh.
And then we make law that way. It's not a way to do business. And so the fortunately the court has been cutting back on the on the young fiction, and the conservative majority, if they're true to their principles and precedents, will do that here and refuse to hear the Montana case.
Right.
Then
let me just say, people can go to our website. I'll give that out here. It's www.11thamendment.org. That's 11thamendment.org. And they'll see on the sidebar on the right, there's a place that says Supreme Court Briefs. And we're posting a little revised version of the second brief. But there's also a place where there's a summary. And that's very simple to file. People can go and see what it is that these justices, the five justices who support the state's rights, are in this pickle, that they support the 11th Amendment, and they'll have to decide. So that's a good way for people to exactly what this vote coming up next week is all about, and why there is a real chance, if we can get Montana to take this argument for themselves through this one-page motion to introduce this officially into the Supreme Court's record, it greatly improves their chances to win the case right here, right now. Citizens United can be effectively reversed right now in time for this election, actually, because their laws would still be in effect. Other states with similar laws would have the confidence to enforce their laws without or with less fear of being challenged in this way, and it's possible that even other states, if the people want and demand it, could pass laws pretty quickly to clear the field of all this corporate money.
Carl, I want to ask you, as we look at this battle that is shaping up with your effort here to force the justices to look at the 11th Amendment and hopefully decline to hear the Montana case, leaving it standing as a critical precedent. Jeffrey Toobin, who is a respected legal scholar and a pretty good journalist, wrote a lengthy piece in The New Yorker, the issue dated May 21st, where he went through in some detail the function of the court under the direction of Chief Justice Roberts, and how the Citizens United case was unremarkable at the beginning in terms of what it presented and the issue that was before the court. But Roberts turned it on its ear and clearly put his mark on this, even though he let another justice write the opinion for internal political reasons. But Roberts is very committed to Citizens United. He seized a small case and turned it into a very major one, and we've seen the implications already. So I'm curious, because the stakes are very high here, and the justices seem to be fairly adroit at ignoring laws that they find inconvenient, even something as important as the 11th Amendment. So what is your take on the degree of investment of the five conservative majority in Citizens United, and how they will balance that against their historical support for the 11th Amendment?
Well, I think our amicus brief is going to shake this all out. We will see. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is the litmus test. There are there are five conservative justices, four you know, so-called the four liberal justices will only will presumably vote not to hear Montana's case, not to grant cert, and let the Montana Supreme Court opinion stand. So that needs that means we only need one of the five conservative justices to peel off and join the liberal minority in order to deny cert and let Montana's state Supreme Court decision stand and effectively overturn Citizens United. Now, the question is whether any of the five will be true to their conservative states' rights principles, will be true to their long record, lengthy record of 11th Amendment jurisprudence, or whether they will simply set that aside, set their own history aside, and vote for the corporation. We're hopeful that one of them, maybe Thomas, maybe Scalito, as you put the two of them, Scalito, maybe one of the three of them mm-hmm. will put conservative principles before corporate power. There is precedent for this. In a long series of opinions and dissents in the 1970s, Justice Rehnquist, who is a very conservative justice, but very influential, he was on the right side of the corporate personhood issue from a conservative perspective. His argument was a states' rights argument that because states create corporations, they have the ultimate ability to regulate them. Mm. And because they have the ability to regulate them as their creators, those corporations are not entitled to Bill of Rights constitutional protections as persons. It was a brilliant series of dissents. It was true to his conservative principles. He was unable to bring other conservative justices along with him, but we're hopeful that all we need here is one like Rehnquist to vote their conservative precepts, and we have dealt a near fatal blow to Citizens United. So that's why we're pulling out all the stops and working so hard before next Thursday when the court might first examine this case.
Well, Carl and Adam, thank you again for joining us today to update us. We're going to do another installment Monday or early next week. We will stay on this issue and keep our listeners apprised. And I've made these podcasts available to all. You don't have to be a subscriber. And I want to encourage listeners who care about this issue, and you should, to share these podcasts, put them up on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, use your email. You can download it and burn it on a CD and give it to people. I want to encourage you to spread this far and wide. Call into radio shows that you listen to and say, hey, did you know that there is a critical challenge to Citizens United and that this is the focus of the court as early as June 14th? These are things, as we've pointed out, that are so far not getting much coverage in the mainstream media. And so we've got to use our own networks to spread the word, build activism. And, of course, our current primary focus is on Governor Schweitzer and Attorney General Bullock in Montana. So go to the show file at peterbcollins.com. Those phone numbers will be listed. Also, the website of the 11th Amendment Movement, 11thamendment.org, a quick link there for you. We want to make this as easy as possible for you to get up to speed and share this information to build activism. Let's start our own prairie fire here and see if we can put a huge dent into Citizens United even before our November election this year. Carl Mayer, Adam Fergatch, we'll talk to you again real soon. Ted Rall returns to our program today. His new book is The Book of Obama.
Well, come on, everybody, get into the spin. Now that he's been in for however long it's been, grin a good old grin, tuck in your second chin, and everybody do the Clinton.
And how do we do the Clinton?
Over to the middle.
Over to the middle.
Straighten up and step light.
Up and step light.
Lean it to the left a little. Now lean a lot to the right.
Lot to the
come
right.
On and take a definite position.
Definite position.
Now do a total turnabout.
Total turnabout.
Shake your finger at the media. See how quick they'll beat you.
Everybody.
everybody do the Clinton.
That is Roy Zimmerman when he was the front man for a group called The Four Men circa 1994. And if you just change Clinton to Obama, you pretty much got the mantra. Ted Rall has a powerful new book out of some cartoons and a lot of commentary. It's called The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Ted, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
It's great to be with you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to talk with you again, and I really appreciate your very clear voice on a number of issues, because we've seen a lot of people who have gone mute since Barack Obama was elected. Those who opposed Bush on torture and wiretapping and targeted assassination now are silent when Barack Obama is the man who has extended wiretapping, who has continued to use rendition, and who has a killer capture program, sans capture, that is even more aggressive and now more open than the one that Dick Cheney had. Did we get any change that we could believe in, Ted?
Well, we got change, maybe, but maybe not change that we would want. In some respects, especially on foreign policy and the war on terror and security issues, the Obama administration's even worse than George W. Bush. I mean, Bush never claimed to have the legal right to assassinate American citizens on American soil. Obama does. Bush didn't personally have a kill list and check it twice to see if you were naughty or nice. Bush does. I mean, Obama does. And Bush lied about the domestic surveillance program run by the NSA, whereas Obama admits it and brags about it. So in many of those ways, things have gotten worse. But, you know, I wanted to comment about what you said in this during the setup about liberals who defend the Obama on these things. You know, I would ask them how they felt back under the Bush years when they heard Republicans selling out traditional conservative values to defend George W. Bush. I mean, George W. Bush presided over an expansive, bigger government, but conservatives were silent about that. George W. Bush was a someone who got involved in nation building, something that they claimed to be against, and someone who drove up the deficit. And these are people who claimed to be very concerned about deficit spending. But they were hypocrites. They had no integrity. They defended they didn't care about their principles. They just cared about the Republican Party. Well, now, how is it any different when liberals betray their own principles in order to defend the Democratic Party? If liberals have principles, then they need to stand up for them, even whether there's a Democrat or a Republican president in charge. And principles always matter, and principles always come first, or they don't mean a damn thing. Unfortunately, too many liberals don't have any integrity any more than conservatives do, and it's a sad thing to see.
It is, really, and what we've seen just in the recent week and a half since the New York Times disclosed details of the so-called kill or capture program and the Tuesday video conference held to take a look at who to kill next, and the direct role played by the President of the United States. And while we now have a controversy surfacing where my senior senator, Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee, wants to crack down on the leakers, it is just stunning to me to see that there isn't a single Democrat so far who I've heard from who says, I got a little problem with the constitutionality of the president's kill program, particularly as it applies to American citizens like Anwar al-Awlaki. And the Times quoted Bill Daley, the former chief of staff at the White House, as Obama telling him that deciding to kill al-Awlaki was easy. and we're hearing very little pushback from the left.
Yeah, I mean, the whole nature of the way that this is playing out in the media is incredibly ass backwards. I mean, first of all, the fact that the leak came within the administration, not from someone who's principled, and if it were someone who was appalled by what was going on and decided to leak it in order to shed some light on it with a view towards ending it, that person would deserve not an investigation, but a medal. But that's not the case. This is the administration themselves bragging about their role to look like, as McCain rightfully said, to look like tough guys during an election year. This is bizarre. This is the kind of information that, when it comes out, should make them look terrible, and they think it's going to make them look good. It's unbelievable. And the fact that this investigation is, as you said, about punishing the leakers is also just plain bizarre. The leakers, I don't know. I don't even know where to start. I mean, everyone involved is just pure scum.
Well, and we have the model of Bradley Manning and other whistleblowers who have been the victims of this administration's vengeance, including the CIA officer Kiriakou, whose offenses, such as they are, occurred during the Bush administration. He's the one who revealed the existence of the videotapes of waterboarding that were then destroyed by a CIA officer who now has a best-selling book. He's allowed to brag about it, while Kiriakou is facing a serious prison sentence.
This is a gangster administration. That's what I used to say about George W. Bush, and it was true. They ran things like gangsters, and Obama has continued this tradition. On domestic policy, things are a little bit different from Bush, at least in terms of tone. But man, on the foreign policy front, there were probably about 3 to 6 months of light when things seemed to be not as bad. Back during the period of the speech in Cairo, and there was discussion about opening dialogue with opening up dialogue with Iran, and all that's out the window. I was giving a couple of appearances. I'm on tour right now for the Book of Obama in the Pacific Northwest, and some people actually say, well, one thing about Obama is he's improved our relations with the rest of the world. Not at all. I mean, maybe for a few months during the Nobel Prize period, but now it's just as bad as ever as it was under Bush. I mean, with the drone strikes in Pakistan and Afghanistan that most of the world finds reprehensible. And we should also talk about the whole distinction between assassinating U.S. citizens and assassinating non-U.S. nationals. I mean, whether we're talking about assassinating Americans or foreigners, we are talking about an unconstitutional, illegal, and brazenly corrupt and immoral act. I mean, these are people who are being killed, many of whom, after the fact, have been proven to be pure, non-combatant civilians, women and children. And even in the case of the people who are supposedly terrorists, these are people who have not, there's no evidence whatsoever against. I mean, if the United States of America has a problem with someone, we should seek their extradition, and we should try them in a court of law, whether they're a U.S. citizen or not.
Well, and number one, there appears to be a John Yoo-like memo that has been written by somebody in the Obama administration that authorizes and justifies these things, but we're not allowed to see it from the administration that claims to be the most transparent in American history. And on the issue of snuffing Americans, whether they're in the United States or not, there is an obstacle called the Fifth Amendment that is not complicated. It's not written in that murky language of the Second Amendment. It's very clear that you shall not be deprived of life or liberty without due process. And in the case of Alaki, advocates for him went to federal court. They took his father as his proxy, and said, I understand my son is on a list of people to be killed, and I object to that, and I think it's unconstitutional. And the court told him to get lost. They said, if Anwar wants to come in here and plead his case, as if that's ever going to happen, that's okay, but you have no standing to challenge the president's unilateral and capricious, arbitrary decision to kill your son. And it's just amazing. There was no process, Ted, not even a kangaroo court at Guantanamo. They didn't even really make a case publicly about Anwar al-Awlaki the way John Ashcroft did about Jose Padilla. It wasn't true, but they actually tried to make a case against the guy before they locked him in a Navy brig and treated him like an enemy combatant.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the case that has come out through leaks about al-Awlaki is a pretty terrifying one. It really boils down to the fact that he was supposedly a propagandist for al-Qaeda, not a combatant, not someone who led troops in the field, Not to mention, let's not forget, America is not at war. There is no war. The United States is not legally involved in a war. Congress has not declared a war in Afghanistan or Pakistan or in Yemen or in Iraq or really anywhere else since 1945. So everything that happens right now in terms of every military action that the United States is involved in is actually unconstitutional. I mean, that's how far we've come. And but the case that they're making against al-Awlaki, you know, they're not even doing the, well, he was scheming. He was going to do a dirty bomb. We're talking about a guy with an opinion. He's expressing his First Amendment right to be in favor of al-Qaeda. Personally, not a point of view that I agree with. But, man, I mean, as someone who flogs opinions, and as you are too, I sure would not like the government to make the case that they have the right to kill us just because they don't like what we have to say.
Yeah. And Ted, it is amazing to see, because there are so many people who, when I raise that issue, just say, oh, you know, you're so literal about that. I mean, come on, they're terrorists. And we saw recently where, on the one hand, the CIA deserves credit for some great spycraft. They planted a double agent inside this alleged group, al-Qaeda, on the Arabian Peninsula. They got him fitted for the new and improved crotch bomb. He took it away. And then they spun the story as if they had busted up a plot to blow up an airliner headed for the United States. That part was simply not true. The double agent told al-Qaeda that. But when it was spun in the American media that we had just been rescued from a dastardly attack, that's bullshit. And yet, the, you know, primary media in this country take it at face value, and then they report this double agent who was, you know, flipped by Saudi intelligence. And so, like I said, on one hand, spycraft, yeah, good work. But why do you have to sell it to us as another fear-up effort where you're pretending that you protected us from a plot that you created?
It's 1984. It's so Orwellian. You know, we've always been at war with East Asia. We will always be at war. We've always been aligned with Eurasia or whatever it is. The propaganda is transparent. It's naked. I mean, it's gotten to the point where you cannot read through an entire issue of the New York Times without finding at least two or three moves, just sort of off-the-cuff moves towards fascism. And these are all examples. I mean, the state power is naked. You know, I mean, one thing that you mentioned, I'm glad you brought it up, is like, well, people say they're all terrorists. Really? To which I reply, how the hell do you know? You don't know anything about it. As far as, you know, we're told these things by the government, but, you know, I want to see 12 ordinary men and women and compose a jury and hear out the evidence, and I want the person to be able to defend themselves. I want to know for sure. We don't know that Osama bin Laden was a terrorist. We don't know anything. I want to see these people on trial.
We don't even know if he was actually in Abbottabad. They destroyed the body they claim that they killed there. And, you know, I believe that Osama bin Laden is dead now, but I don't particularly believe the story, partly because the White House couldn't get it straight. There were five different versions in the first 5 days after it was reported.
It was very much like the Jessica Lynch and the Pat Tillman stories. They kept changing.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of like, well, they say it's so difficult to get the facts. Really? Now, it seems like it's difficult to nail down your spin. Right? Because, I mean, those guys went in, the Navy SEAL Team 6 went into Abbottabad with, you know, with live feed cameras streaming this information straight into the White House Situation Room. They were watching, you know, the president and his cabinet were watching these things. So they knew exactly what happened. They were told within seconds what happened. They knew instantly what happened. The only reason that the story kept changing was because they kept changing the story. Shows some incompetent propagandizing, honestly. But, you know, they can't get it straight. It's just kind of amazing that we tolerate this, you know, buffoonery and this mix of buffoonery and fascism. Because at least the thing that you'd like to think about, a tyrannical government, is at least they'd be efficient and smart.
Well, and now we've moved into a rotating dictatorship.
it is a rotating dictatorship. I mean, you know, whether you get Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, you can be sure that there's not going to be a candidate who is going to ramp down the militarism or the secure or the surveillance, the police state that we live in today.
Ted Rall is with us. He spells his name R-A-L-L, and that's important if you want to go to his website, rall.com. He is a cartoonist. He's an author. He's an essayist. And, Ted, I just visited your website last night and picked up that you now have a gig with MSDNC.
Yes, it's not the exciting, well-paid one on TV, but it's a, they have a new blog called Lean Forward, and MSNBC is running my column there, my blog entries. And my first one just went up. It was an attempt to deconstruct why the jobs numbers are much worse than you might think just by looking at them. And it's actually great because, obviously a bigger audience is better, and they seem to be pretty cool with letting me be myself. So hopefully that'll last.
Ted, I take no swipe at you for being an inside agitator in corporate media. I've worked for ABC, for CBS. I work for some outfit now called Cumulus that owns radio stations. And I accept the opprobrium of some people as a corporate sellout because I can get into the mainstream media and offer my dangerous lefty viewpoints. And so to the extent that you can burrow in there and present ideas that are a little bit more independent and objective from what we see on the cable news channel, I say right on.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, I think people who follow me know that I wouldn't tamp down my my opinions in order to get a gig. I would rather, but you know, that said, yeah. I mean, I have in the past worked for Fortune Magazine, Times, the New York Times. So, and I would again happily. So, those are, you know, the more exposure, the better. Mm-hmm. Like we have to get the ideas out there one way or the other. This is the media that we have. I mean, it's not like I'm even getting a call from Current TV, you know, so anything I can get is good.
Now, I'll make sure that Phil Griffin does not hear this conversation, but I've got to raise something with you since you have some connection to MSNBC. Since the New York Times reported the details of the killer capture program, Rachel Maddow has not said one word about it. And I consider her to be one of the better people on MSNBC. The work she does is excellent. The stories she chooses to cover, I think she does good work on. But her show has turned into a parade of opposition research stories about Mitt Romney and the Republicans. There isn't even any glad-handing coverage of the Democrats in Congress. There's occasionally a story about Elizabeth Warren's run for the Senate in Massachusetts. But it's 90% negative information about Republicans and never a critical word of the Obama administration.
Well, I've observed that myself, and I totally agree with what you said. What Rachel decides to do, she does extremely well. It's intelligent television. That's a rare thing. But we're defined as much by what we choose not to cover as what we do. And the kill list is the big story of the month. Arguably the year, and it's being, and she and other hosts there are just not talking about it. I think Chris Matthews has talked about it a bit.
Well, Chris Hayes deserves credit. He's got the weekend show, and he writes for The Nation. He had Jeremy Scahill on last weekend and did just a straight-up job on the story, and I give him credit. But in prime time, it's all pro-Obama all the time. And I'm sorry, I can't give it any better grade than I would the Fox News Channel now.
Well, the biggest embarrassment has been Reverend Al Sharpton, from whom I expected much bigger things. And he has just, it's relentless Democratic Party talking points. You know, an interesting thing is back at the height of the conservative, of the Republican/conservative alliance between media and the White House, I remember hearing Rush Limbaugh talk about how it's important for conservatives to attack the Republican Party from the right in order to, first of all, drag it to the right, but also to understand that conservatism continues whether or not the Republican Party does, and that the conservative principles are what matters, not the Republican Party. Now, of course, obviously, it's Rush Limbaugh, and there's a lot of spin there. But I do like the general idea, and I think that liberals could take a page from that, take a cue from that. Liberalism should live or die based on of its own accord. Progressivism should live or die regardless of the Democratic Party. It is much better for progressives to see the Democratic Party lose and adhere to their principles strongly than to, you know, compromise them, sell out their own principles just to try to get helped out a Democrat elected.
Ted Rawlins with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Tom Petty picked up an old tune from Thunderclap Newman. In Ted Rawls' new book, The Book of Obama, he talks about how he spent time with various Occupy protest camps, and he writes, I say, bring on the extreme solutions, because multi-trillion dollar deficits and endless war and mass die-offs of species and climate change are pretty fucking extreme. We've had enough half-assed compromises to deal with them. There are many candidates for America's biggest problem, so it's tough to pick one. It could just as easily be education or immigration or a bunch of other issues. Still, as the foreclosures and layoffs piled up and the unemployment checks ran out for tens of millions, the issue that emerged as the one that would get the most attention was the one that the media and political elites had been ignoring for over 40 years, income inequality. And Ted, I think your book really presents these issues in a very clear way. You have a strong point of view. And you believe that our political system is essentially broken and that efforts to reform the process will really just nibble around the edges. Tell me what you see as what's needed to fix the American system.
Well, you know, there's two issues. When you're asking about a political system, is it reformable is one of them. In other words, can it be fixed in order to work for itself and to self-perpetuate itself? But then the next question is it redeemable? In other words, was it ever, even if it worked perfectly, would it get us closer to a world that we prefer or one that we don't? I think that the American system of government was never redeemable in the first place. If we start from the idea that we're not all created equal, that some people deserve to live real, full, rich lives and other people don't just by the virtue of accident of birth. But now we're at the point where we also understand that even if you don't care about those principles, the system is even internally is just it just cannot be reformed. I mean, you can see, for instance, the inability of the political classes to address the economic crisis. They cannot do anything about it, and as a result, we're heading towards a period of increasing political instability and polarization, and we're losing the center. And so the question is, what do we do instead? Look, I mean, if we don't do anything, and I think that's probably what's going to happen, we're going to see disintegration and eventual collapse. Eventual could be next week, it could be in 10 years, but we're going to end up like the Soviet Union. The thing is just going to fall apart, and we're going to have, it's already an empty husk. I argued in the Anti-American Manifesto, and I continue with that argument in the Book of Obama, that it's a revolution would be preferable. Now, I'm not naive. Right now, there is no organized left in the United States, the left being a real left, an organization or organizations that strives for the radical transformation of society economically, politically, and socially. We don't have that. So we're not going to have a revolution, at least not until that organization comes up. But let's form it. Let's organize. It's better to have a revolution, as messy and violent as that is, than it is to have a collapse. Because at least with a revolution, there's infrastructure left. The economy is not completely destroyed. Collapse is slow and brutal and grinds everything down. By the time it's all over, there's nothing left to really be worth taking over. We don't want to go the way of Somalia. We really would rather, or Russia for that matter. It would be much better to to transform the society, this richest country that's ever existed, and turn it into a system that works better for everybody.
But the Koch brothers and their ilk would rather destroy it as opposed to seeing any kind of broad-based movement that represents the average American. They're willing to take it down, and we have the Democrats who want to compromise. Well, let's just take it down a little bit, guys. Let's just put one group of people at risk and you know, see if we can trade off here.
Yeah, that's right. That's how it is. Well, you know, the Koch brothers are operating within the existing system, and that's part of the reason why we need to get rid of it entirely. I mean, the existing system operates for the 1%, not for the 99%, and that's just not going to change. You know, you can just sort of see the direction. You know, whether you're talking about ecological crisis or the economy or any number of major issues that we deal with, there's just nothing gets better. It just keeps getting worse and worse. And it's because we're at that historical point. You know, we weren't at that historical point in the 30s. In the 30s, the system was able to reform itself. We weren't at that historical point in the 60s for the same reason. Yeah. But I think we're there now.
Ted, I'd love to talk with you further, but I promised to let you go so you can move on to your next event on your book tour. I want to recommend your book to provoke people's thinking and to hear the clear voice that you offer on these issues. Ted Rall, R-A-L-L, The Book of Obama. It's from Seven Stories Press and available in softcover at your local independent bookstore if you still got one. Ted, always a pleasure. Keep doing it, will you?
Thank you, Peter. I certainly will. You too.
All right. That's Ted Rall right here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for joining me today. Why don't you send me an email and let me know what you think? Full of it at peterbcollins.com.
Trails to until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.